IO Chicago is what brought me to Chicago. And I remember we drove up and we saw a show, and I think like TJ Jagodowski, Jack McBrayer, a bunch of other great people were in the show, Bob Dassey, Jen Bills, and it blew me away. Hi, I'm Tim Baltz. Drove to Chicago. I'm an actor, writer, comedian. I think I was 15, maybe, when a friend of mine who was a year younger had his older stepbrother was on a Herald team at IO Chicago. So this would have been mid-90s. So this was either 95 or early 96. I mean, I had always liked comedy and had come up watching a lot of comedy with my friends and my dad introducing me to things, but I definitely always joked around in class and was trying to make my friends laugh. But that was the first time that I kind of saw how some of the sausage was made, and it was so fluid and so smart. I remember thinking, this is incredibly smart, and it's theatrical too, especially the way that they do the Heralds there and at the point of evolution that it was at. Was really inspiring. And I remember thinking, I have to do this. I don't want to tell anyone. I was deathly shy when I was younger. And I remember thinking, I have to do this. I have to go to school in Chicago and I have to do this.
Welcome to the CISO C Show. I'm Andrew Steven. Today on the show, we're talking with Tim Baltz, who plays Glenn on CISO's Bajillion Dollar Properties. And throughout the conversation, there were two themes that kept coming up: working hard and Chicago.
My friends and I would go up to the city. We'd take the train up. We'd sleep on like the floor of my friend's dad's office or something like that. And we'd see IO shows, as many as we could. And then I went to school there and I'd go see shows on weekends or free nights. And honestly, I didn't really know that much about Second City. I'd seen a show or two there, and then I got hired. I was going through the conservatory and I got hired for the touring company, and I didn't even know what it was. My friend Jordan Klepper was on it, and Sarah Haskins, they were on it, but I didn't know what it was. And I got hired, and our conservatory shows were on Monday nights. And the lady that hired me, Beth Kligerman, she said, okay, so your first understudy home show is going to be, you know, May 5th with one of the touring companies. And I was like, oh, that's a Monday. I can't. I have my conservatory show. And she kind of like just incredulously looked at me and was like, you will be skipping that. And I didn't know. So I was Second City. I learned a lot more about, obviously I knew the pedigree and, you know, I had the 40th anniversary book and the CDs with the sketches on it. And I listened to that. And a lot of my favorite people had gone through there, but IO was really the thing that got me really passionate about comedy, and the doorway to that was really improv.
Entertainment has always been a big part of this city, and one institution that has gone from strength to strength is Comedy Theater Second City.
If you recognize that voice, that's Stephen Fry. And in 2007, 2008, he made a miniseries documentary called Stephen Fry in America, where he traveled around the U.S., visiting points of interest and sharing his experience.
Comedy improvisation could be said to have come of age at this institution. For half a century, some of the greatest and most famous comedians in the world have started their careers here.
And that voice is Tim Baltz.
Your girlfriend's in there right now.
Oh, great. I haven't seen her in a while.
Whoa. how could I tell this? She's lost her clothes.
Whoa. Yeah. Maybe she went out here for 5 minutes.
Whoa.
All right, 2 minutes.
What was it like meeting Stephen Fry?
Man, talk about a guy who plays at the height of his intelligence. That was incredible. He's such a nice man. He's so smart. You know, he makes other people catch up to him, which is always impressive. But he's also so nice. I was shocked at how nice he was, and my friend Brendan and I got asked to take him to this famous hot dog place, the Wiener Circle.
Now listen, Second City, it was the end of the rainbow for you if you had comedy ambition.
You get hired and you go inside and they show you there's a tape closet with the tapes of all the shows that they've ever done and the scripts from all those shows. And they open it up and you look at the cast list and it's like, you know, you look and it'll be Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Gilda Radner in one show, you know?
Do you think there's something about Chicago that has made those institutions there, or did it just coincidence that they've ended up there?
No, it's definitely not by design, but it's a breeding ground for all of that. I mean, the Compass Players, which turned into Second City, started at University of Chicago, which obviously is, you know, kind of the Harvard of the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And Chicago kind of politically and theatrically is always poised to have that. Plus it's a big enough town that you can have a normal audience that isn't just, you know, comedy students basically, which is usually the best and worst part of every comedic institution, is Chicago included. But you know, IO and Second City in Chicago also get like a normal crowd that isn't comedy students, you know, who can't get in because they can only see shows for free if the shows aren't sold out. And theatrically, there's the Goodman, there's the Steppenwolf, you know, there was the Remains Theater. There are all these storefront black box theaters, and it's a rich tradition of that. And that kind of informs, I think, the style of improv, probably. I think if you look at all the big cities that have improv in the U.S. or Canada, and even I've gotten to travel a little bit in Europe and see what their influences are, you can see how the town influences the style. And I always kind of liked that. I'm partial to Chicago because I did a lot of theater before I started doing improv. And so I like Toronto a lot. I like the scene up there a lot, but Chicago still ranks kind of number one for me.
It's called the Windy City because in the 19th century, they said that the politicians in Chicago were full of hot air.
Oh, is that? It's windy in that sense.
Yeah.
The windy person is
like blowhards.
Yeah, blowhards, as you call them. Exactly.
And they had that reputation because they also had the reputation of being the second city. They were second to New York all the time. And it's always kind of had that chip on its shoulder, but since it's such a working class town, it doesn't mind having that chip. It's always working.
Yeah.
It never rests.
Chicago has three major comedic institutions. It has Second City, it has IO, and it has the Annoyance Theater. So Second City, obviously, you know, you're like up on stage, shirt and tie, 300 people in the audience pretty much every night. IO is, you know, kind of a little bit more of a jazz club, home of long form. Annoyance started in the late 80s as a response to both, and it's run by Mick Napier and Jen Eslin. And they've always been great about, you know, they let people's freak flag fly. You go there and you do whatever you want. But Chicago's informed by that in a sense because you're not, you know, everyone defends where they come from naturally. But there you've got three different groups defending each other. So you can't really feel too cool about your school because then you've got two others being like, well, you know, no offense, but fuck you.
Yeah.
you're not as cool as you think you are. And that kind of forces you to cross train if you want to be the best in that town or if you want to compete with the best. You kind of have to cross train with all those different styles. And ultimately, you end up in places, whether it's like smaller theaters around town, where you're, you know, commingling with all those people. And that's encouraged because it's a walking town. I don't know that much about New York, but I've heard that New York is similar. You know, people at the Pit and Magnet and UCB will kind of share the community like that. I think that LA is car based and that might prevent it a little bit.
Yeah, there definitely feels like a bit more like competitiveness here in the different schools.
Yeah. And the presence of the industry.
Yeah.
And I think that New York has that a little bit less and Chicago has that far less. In fact, before 2009, when managers and agents first started to kind of swoop into Chicago and pick people up, it was really devoid of that. I mean, you know, people, like SNL showcases in Chicago before 2009, no one was doing 5-minute sets. Can you believe that?
No.
They were doing improv shows and then SNL people would come and watch an improv show. Why would you hire someone for SNL based off an improv showcase? And I did a couple and felt pretty good about them. I remember I was interning at IO in 2004, maybe, when John Lutz got hired from an Armando, which is like similar to ASCAT. And I remember thinking that's the best I've ever seen anyone do in an improv show ever.
Oh, wow.
If he was on stage six times, he hit six grand slams. It was so impressive. My jaw was on the floor. And he was great. And I remember Sharna being like, you know, Jack's not much of a writer, but they're looking at him, you know, for a writing position. And he was so funny that it was a natural fit. He's one of those guys that, you know, when I was a student, I was looked up to. He, Pete Gross, Dan Bacadall, Rob Janis were in this group called Foursquare. And they, again, were a huge influence because they were so smart. And because of the theatrical presence in Chicago, you kind of, I don't think you have to play with heart. But it is definitely one option that you can absolutely go for.
So do you think, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about like, if you can start in Chicago. And I'm just curious how much of that you think is just bias or like defending your home, like you mentioned, or is it there a literal, like it kind of is helpful?
Well, I mean, I think it's helpful for some people. You know, if I were super hot guy, I think I would come out to LA right away. Because,
and if you're talented and a hard worker, you can make it happen anywhere.
Exactly, exactly. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had a lot of exploring to do in comedy and in Chicago in general. And, you know, I grew up an hour southwest of Chicago, past the suburbs in a town called Joliet. And I think that Chicago, I never really thought that I'd leave Chicago, but I didn't see where the ceiling was. And I think that you can spend 6-8 years in Chicago without realizing there's a ceiling, and then you hit it and you realize, oh no, I have to move. And that happened to me for sure. But I would say, if you like experimenting in different styles and you, that's how you want to find your voice, then I think that Chicago is right for you in that sense. It's not to say that other cities aren't. I think that they are more and more, and Chicago just kind of you know, was first on the mantle there because of its history, and it had a longer history than the other towns. But I, you know, I wouldn't counsel against it. I also think there have been so many migrations from Chicago that if you're a younger person and you're thinking about it, now is the time to go because there's a ton of opportunity and a lot of stage time to be had there. And that's always great. You can't discount the stage time. That's a huge part of getting your reps. Like stand-ups will talk about, like, I got to get my reps. And in Chicago, I mean, God, there were times when I literally could have done a show 7 nights a week at IO in Chicago for like a year and a half. And sometimes I did, to the detriment of all my other relationships and the job I was working at the time.
Is it just like the golden proportion of stages and performers?
Yeah, there are a lot of people that move there all the time to do shows, but there are just a ton of independent venues where you can do shows. You know, you get an indie team together. So, you know, we'd be in classes and we'd just get like a team of 8 people together and go do a show, do bar prov, do indie theaters that have, you know, like 3 teams playing. There's a team that's hosting and then 2 openers. And you can just do that for years, getting your reps up. And then once you're kind of established at IO, maybe you're playing Armando, maybe you're playing on a house team on the weekends, and then one of your indie teams gets a slot, so you can arguably get like, you know, 2-3 slots a week at IO. And once you're at Second City, if you're touring, then you have an improv set after your show. You do 2 acts, and then you have an improv set, so you get those reps. And when you're on a stage, main stage, well, the ETC stage is Thursday to Sunday, and then they have extended summer hours. So you'll have, you know, 6 shows a week, and you'll do, you know, 3 sets a week. And then main stage, you have, it's Tuesday to Sunday, you have 8 shows a week, and you're doing sets Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. You're doing 5 sets a week. I mean, that's, the reps are, everyone kind of goes through a postpartum thing when they leave main stage because you have so many reps that your brain is functioning at that level, and there's no other way to spend energy like that unless you're someone who thrives in front of a laptop.
Yeah. Do you miss it?
Maybe at this point. I left at the end of 2012.
And how long were you there for?
I toured for 2.5 years, and then I did 2 shows on the ETC over 2 years and 1 show on the main stage for about 9 months. I didn't like the schedule of main stage. It's a grind. 6 days a week, yeah. 8 shows a week.
That's tough.
Kind of like not eating cheese or drinking beer because I was worried about losing my voice all the time. You know, I mean, you have to think about those things because it's an equity house. You're an actor's equity actor. You're not just an improviser, which I really loved about that. And then, you know, people's attitudes differ about that. But
well, yeah, I'm just curious because you talked about you sort of fell in love with improv. And so maybe one, like, what was it about improv that just drew you to it? And then two, how did you reconcile that with doing these scripted pieces? I mean, obviously they're related, but they're two different parts of the same whole.
What I loved about improv was that it was collaborative and, you know, it's very much three-dimensional or four-dimensional. I didn't get far enough in science to know what four-dimensional means, but it feels deeper.
It's 18-dimensional.
18, yeah.
It's really...
You kind of have to juggle all these different things, right? You have the jokes in your head. You have to listen really hard. In a Herald, you have to, you know, juggle all these balls and try to make some kind of cohesive piece. It felt, not to sound too dorky, but it felt like really funny kind of poetry up on its feet because you're taking a suggestion in the best shows ever there in that style, said something while being really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me was the highest degree of difficulty. And I was always impressed by that. I don't know about other people. I'm most impressed by the highest degree of difficulty. If someone's just hitting low hanging fruit or shooting fish in a barrel over and over, that's great. And it's definitely a skill to learn. This town has absolutely taught me that you need to know what your look is, what your style is, and you need to capitalize on that mm-hmm. before someone's going to say, what else do you have? Chicago doesn't always teach people that, but, IO definitely was a love because it seemed like you kind of, all your senses had to be heightened. You had to be aware of everyone as much as possible and you had to be as smart as possible. You had to play at the height of your intelligence. So I loved that. Then Second City kind of blended my previous love of theater with that improv. And the more I got to know about it, then you really get immersed in the history of it and you see all the pictures on the wall and it's hard not to really want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people that should have moved to LA sooner, but they wanted to be on a stage and you can't really fault them for that. It's a really, really special place and you get to do work there that you really don't get to do in other parts of the country. It's rare to have a captive audience the way that Second City has a captive audience. You know, 180 people in the ETC theater, 300 people in the main stage theater. If you've ever done a play and that audience is there, kind of captive, waiting for you to say something. If that's a thrill to you and you also love comedy, then Second City's great. And even if that's not a thrill to you, it's still 300 people. I mean, you get to test stuff and the way they write shows are over 3 months. You're slowly replacing the old show with pieces of the new show until it's all new material. And then you refine it and you have an opening night. And all that takes 3 months. And I mean, you're out of ideas after like 5 weeks. You're done. Yeah. And you're basically running on fumes for like 7 or 8 more weeks. And it's really, really challenging. It feels like finals week every night. And you get to watch things live and die and gain strength and lose strength. And it's a really, really great, frustrating, unique process.
Yeah, you mentioned that audience. Is there too like a pressure that you don't want to let these people down because they are such a good audience ready to see what you have?
Rachel Dratch had a great quote where she's like, you know, for some of these people in the crowd tonight, every night, it's going to be their only time seeing Second City in their life. So I want to do the best show possible and hopefully the show that we wrote and had on opening night and that we've, you know, refined to a great place. And I like that attitude. I like the challenge of the theater before knowing about Second City. And I definitely like that challenge while doing it. That I kind of moved out to LA because we sold that pilot and we needed to work on it out here. And then once I was out here, I pretty quickly I got on Drunk History as an ensemble member or a, you know, series regular. And that was really, really fun. I ended up doing season 2 and season 3 of that. And the first year I was here, I got to do a handful of guest spots on some fun shows. And was just, you know, auditioning more and more regularly. Realizing like, okay, the sun is kind of set on SNL and solo sketch is fun, but it's not something that I want to be doing 24/7. It's fun to kind of get to focus full time on acting and writing, but I was kind of in a holding pattern waiting to see what would happen with this pilot over at Pivot. And that's pretty stressful, just kind of waiting for, you know, powers outside of your control to make decisions on your stuff. And it can really stunt your creativity. And then at the end of 2015, just kind of bam, 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 a handful of things popped up and I realized, oh, this is great. Like, I really like this character. And the bajillion audition process was great. I mean, I read the character, which wasn't really my type at all, but they said, you know, they're open to different takes on this character. There was something in the sides about his dad. He thought that his dad had died in the real life version of the movie Predator. And Predator, honestly, is one of my favorite movies. So I didn't even have to brush up on it. I just went in knowing, like, if I get to improvise about the movie Predator, I'm going to be able to go forever. There's like 50 lines in the movie Predator, and I know all of them. So it started, and we were improvising, and, you know, I mean, it got to the Predator moment, and I just kept throwing in a ton of Predator stuff. Kind of making Kulop laugh, and it just kept going and going and going.
It seems so interesting. It seems like you've gotten incredibly lucky with some of the people you've been able to work with. I mean, you mentioned your Second City crew, the Bajillion Dollar Properties cast. I mean, not only does everyone have amazing things to say about everyone, but just the talent there. And then you got to be on Veep also, which is just another amazing cast.
Yeah, I didn't even audition for it.
Yeah?
No, I booked that off a table read.
Oh, wow.
I was one of three other actors to do the season 3 table read before they started shooting. And what they do is they get the entire cast in the room and then a couple other people so that, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Gary Cole don't have to read, you know, Shopping Clerk number one. And that character that I ended up playing was like a Zuckerberg type in Silicon Valley. It was like the last day and the last scene that we were doing in the week. And I was just like nose to nose with Julia the whole time. And I kept making her laugh and apparently left the room. And she went up to Iannucci and was like, he's got to play that part. He's like, okay. And then I told my manager, it was great. I got to read as Jonah because Tim Simons was gone for the first two days. Wow. I just got to swear and improvise like a blue streak for 2 days. It was so much fun. And I told my manager afterwards, I was like, hey, you know, this happened. It was pretty cool. And then they offered me the part. And my manager's like, yeah, I was wondering. I had some other clients I was going to send out for that part. Huh. What?
Don't tell me that.
Were you going to send me out for it? And the truth is, it's super hard to book stuff from Chicago. And I hadn't moved yet.
Oh, wow.
So that was my first TV gig. My first TV gig, thankfully, the first shot starts over my shoulder on the entire cast of Veep. And I just, like, two or three takes was just shitting my pants. And then they turned around, and they're on me. And I'm like, okay, all right. I think maybe change my undershirt, and I'm ready to go. I was sweating so much.
Sorry, guys. My size of a planet bad.
Greg Jurgensen, as I live and breathe in the genius. Kent Davidson.
Selena.
It's Madam Vice President.
It's Madam Vice President.
I'm sorry. Oh. Madam Vice President.
Right.
Right. I shouldn't say this because I majored in math, but you have my 1,000% attention.
Wow, that's a lot. I'm thrilled to hear that.
Excuse me one moment. Have you heard from Indonesia?
That was a trip. And they were so cool. That was such a great introduction because you realize that it just doesn't pay to be an asshole.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. Like, it pays to be professional and it pays to be like, hey, sorry, I need to do this to focus. But it doesn't pay to be a judgmental prick, basically. And none of those people are. They're all salt of the earth, the nicest people. Oh, God, Tony Hale and Gary Cole and Kevin Dunn had Chicago connections and Matt Walsh. Mm-hmm. So they were really nice. And Matt Walsh had done a bunch of annoyance stuff in Chicago. So we talked about that. And Julia she toured at Second City and we kind of talked about that a little bit.
That's surreal.
It was crazy. And Iannucci has done some of my favorite shows ever. That was nuts. I still can't believe I did that. I wish I could go back and do it again because it was the first TV thing I ever did.
Bring back the character. We'll start a Twitter campaign.
You know what? They almost brought it back. Well, they write so much for that show and they rewrite. We were 2 days away from flying out for another bid on season 4. And 2 days before we were supposed to fly out, they're like, yeah, that scene got cut. We're so sorry.
And speaking of writing, you know, that's an excellently written show. Did you get a chance to do any improv on that, or was it all what was written? And then, I mean, obviously Bajillion, which is much more improv. Like, how do you, as someone who respects both acting and writing and improv, balance those two worlds?
Okay, so the first part of the question on Veep, there is a little bit of improv. Honestly, it's so collaborative and cool to watch in action because they're just trying to get the joke to work. Like, yeah. There's no real ego involved. And that's the other thing that, like, once you get to that level and you get that professional, there's the best people don't have the ego involved. They just want the joke to work. And the people that do have the ego involved, it's like, man, you're making yourself worse with this. You're being stubborn or you're being judgmental or whatever. So they would, you know, they would get the script, and while they're shooting it, you know, they'd usually always have a steady cam to find any improv, but then they would switch lines. They'd be like, okay, Tony, that line is better if Gary says it. So Gary, you say that. And then that shifts this line to Selena's character. So Julia, you'll say that line now, and that'll make the joke work. And then they'd be like, oh yeah. And then this, then they'd add a little tag or something like that. So, you know, I'm always in favor, especially if there's a script that you like, get the script, cover it, and then go wild. You know, I did a pilot with Amy Poehler directed for NBC this year that didn't go, which is such a bummer because we left all being like, this was the greatest thing.
Yeah, all the little stuff that I saw about it looked amazing.
Oh, it was so great. Great experience. Net positive. But, you know, she called them fun runs. She's like, once we get it, then we can have some fun runs. You really, I think, have to look at it as where is the joke coming, and where then, if we're going to try some alts, where are the alts best placed? Bajillion was different, shifting to that, in that it was semi-scripted. So I'm sure Mandel and Dan and Kulap, I'm sure they all kind of explained that. There'd be sample dialogue, and sometimes that was the funniest thing. You know, if you're doing like a quick 20 or 30 second scene and you need to hit these beats, then you should probably hit those and get out. Or maybe the button on that little scene, you can come up with six different alts and you can film that. But they were great about like letting us go for a while and kind of finding the beats naturally. And that was a really fun way to work because you can choose with your scene partners to go in specifically, or the director will say, let's go in specifically, let's do the beats that are in the sides, and then we'll go fishing for other stuff after that. Or start wherever, go wherever. At a certain point, we might yell, you know, like, let's hit that beat real quick so that we have it. But they were very open to finding totally new stuff. And it was character-based, so it's not like you're trying to invent something in the scene or a game within the scene. You can, but really, I mean, if you're looking at that like an editor, I would assume that an editor is always saying like, okay, well, I need to demonstrate that this character is feeling X, Y, or Z. So as long as you're in character, it's fine. I think I realized at a certain point, especially once I'd been doing comedy in Chicago for a little while, was that my favorite comedies always had great actors and who were able to commit to a part and play it out over the course of a movie or, you know, a lengthy TV series. And that commitment to me seemed the most essential part of kind of selling the comedy, no matter what kind of character it was, whether it's high status, low status, a child, an old person, it didn't matter. That commitment was necessary.
And that kind of echoes that Rachel Dratch quote.
For some of these people in the crowd tonight, every night, it's going to be their only time seeing Second City in their life. So I want to do the best show possible.
Yeah.
And that to me is the biggest challenge and the biggest reward. I want to do the best show possible.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Is there anything you'd like to promote, plug?
Not really. I mean, on Twitter, I'm @Tim_Baltz. And, you know, season 2 of Bajillion's coming out in the fall. That'll be really exciting. Hopefully, all our fans from season 1 follow that.
Yeah.
And we're really excited about it. We had a great time. There's some big, big guests that we can't even talk about on it.
Thank you again. That's the show this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to hear previous episodes, You can search The CISO C-Show wherever you listen to podcasts or find more at CISOshow.com. That's SEESOshow.com. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.